Stone. Wanna see my picture on the cover. Stone. Wanna buy 5 copies for my mother. Yeah. Stone. Wanna see my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is Rolling Stone magazine. Continue to read from the May 2025 edition. In Random Notes, Godfather Part 2. Drill pioneer Young Chop is feeling good. After 2 years in jail, the architect of Chicago's influential sound says he's ready to get back to music. Chicago producer Young Chop is flashing a beaming grin, riding in a passenger seat while traveling through his hometown. His trademark locks are gone. Instead, he's rocking a small afro. Perhaps part of the reason for his good mood is the news, shortly before we speak over Zoom, that Chief Keek's 2012 hit Love Sosa, which Chop produced, had been certified diamond after more than a decade. My mouth dropped when I seen that come past my mentions, he says. I was too happy. Years later, he still remembers how he created Love Sosa with Keith. We was in the studio on some cool stuff that day, Chop, age 31, recalls. I made the beat in 5 to 10 minutes. He had one verse to the song like, we're going to finish it later on. A few days later, when Keith heard that French Montana was trying to buy the ethnemic beat, he came back to the studio. He said, hell nah, man, pull that shit up. I'm finna gonna put up another verse on it. And he finished strong. The song helped catapult the Chicago drill movement from a bubbling underground scene into a worldwide phenomenon that now includes variants in the UK, France, Brooklyn, and more. Chop's crucial role in grafting that sound is why he's been given titles like the Godfather of Drill. As much success as he saw in the early 2010s, Chop's timeline has also been marked by a dark period when bad decisions took him to what he called rock bottom. These days, he doesn't speak much on the gloomier times, preferring to focus on new music. He recently dropped a new EP, a 4-piece, featuring the viral single Chicken, and he has plans to make more music soon with Keith, who's now based in L.A. I tell him we got to do a project, Chop says. When I get to California, we're going to be working on it. His return to music feels like a triumph, considering where he was just a few years ago. Chop came home last December after 2 years in the Gwinnett County Jail outside of Atlanta, Georgia, on charges that stemmed from prior probation violations. The jail stint came after a public spiral that included unprovoked shots at artists including 21 Savage and Meek Mill. During an April 2020 Instagram live session, Chop streamed himself looking for 21 Savage in Atlanta. He was later arrested for reckless conduct after his Uber driver claimed Chop flashed a gun at a car next to them, causing the people in the other vehicle to fire. A week later, he was arrested on aggravated cruelty to animal charges after allegedly starving his dog. Soon after, footage leaked of him shooting a gun from his porch. He became a go-to content for the sensationalist underbelly of rap media, but it seemed like his life was unraveling. Chop had lost his grandmother, mother, and uncle in the mid to late 2010s, and in July 2019, he was open to media personality DJ Small Eyes about how their deaths sent him into a depression. Yeah, probably, he says, when I ask if those losses played a part in his actions. Then he turns skeptical. I don't know. I don't think that was that. It was just some other shit going on. One thing he's resolute about is regret for what happened in 2020. That shit was stupid, he says. I was tweaking. But when I asked him how he's grieving, he says he tries not to think about that. He offers a similar answer when asked about the deaths of two artists who were close to him. Johnny Mae Cash, who was with his brother, and YB, while he was incarcerated. It seems that, as with many young black men, he's still processing his feelings on loss. During his time in jail, Chop spent a week in a mental health pod and says he got into a lot of fights, including one because a man mocked Chop for talking to himself. He says he wasn't. But there's also creativity in jail. He would often buy beats on his tablet and write songs. Chop wrote Mop from his most recent EP while incarcerated. He made the rest of a four-piece after he came home. The project demonstrates Chop in top form as a producer, interweaving dark keys, spicy synths, and immersive samples. As for what's next, Chop promises freshness. New money, just new everything, he says, and updated me on some cool laid-back shit, not some crazy rah-rah shit, you know. Also in random notes, speaking up, Rhiannon Giddens refuses to let history be forgotten. The songwriter and banjoist talks about canceling her Kennedy Center gig, working with Beyonce, and more. Rhiannon Giddens is juggling a dizzyingly handful of upcoming projects when she logs on to Zoom. There's Biscuits and Banjos, the inaugural festival she organized this spring in Durham, North Carolina, which she surmises could be one of the largest ever gatherings of black string band musicians. There's her highly anticipated reunion with the Carolina Chocolate Drops at that festival. There's also What Did the Blackbird Say to the Crow?, Giddens' new record, with fiddler Justin Robinson, one of the original Carolina Chocolate Drops. The album represents a radical return to her roots. Giddens on banjo and Robinson on fiddle, running through a series of mostly instrumental tunes. There are probably people who are going to be like, this is really fucking boring. Why did she put this out? She says. Other people might go, I've been waiting for this my whole life. Giddens spent an hour sharing pointed critiques, reflective musings, and unfiltered thoughts about all sorts of topics. The interview. What was the spark of the idea for your new album? Rhiannon. Justin and I have a special thing because he's the only person who plays fiddle, who I play with, who also has played with Joe Thompson, our mentor. There are a lot of tunes that have never been recorded with us playing them, and I just went, God, if I got hit by a bus tomorrow, this is gone. So I said, we should record ourselves, just fiddle and banjo, no percussion, no guitar, nobody else. We should do this as kind of an anti-AI. I was coming off my most produced record ever, 2023's You're the One. I was like, how cool would it be to get a major label to put out literally the most basic old-time record? Question. Musicians sometimes describe this mentality of one for me, one for them, when balancing their own artistic desires with the realities of the industry. Does that attitude resonate with you? Rhiannon. A little bit, I have to say. I have a great label at Nonesuch. They really follow my vision and have been wonderful. I do sometimes feel the pressure of the industry. I would never show up to award shows. I would never put on makeup. But I do those things so that doesn't become a thing. I don't want people talking about the fact that I'm not wearing makeup. I want them to talk about the fact that I was nominated for a song about somebody who was lynched. Question. How are you navigating these dynamics during our particularly difficult and scary moment? Rhiannon. Those of us who are already activist artists, part of me gets angry because it's like, why is it always the people who are already doing shit that are being expected to do more shit, rather than the people who have been silent their whole career and have reaped the benefits from it? Can we not ask them to say something, to put their money where their mouth is? Question. You canceled your Kennedy Center show after Trump took over the institution's board and moved your show to the Anthem, a nearby venue. Was that a hard decision? It was really hard. I was like, why would it be this year that I have a show there? She laughs. I wanted to stay and stick it out. Then as things unfolded, I thought, who am I going to be playing for? I'm actually taking a huge risk by taking my seated Kennedy Center show to a 5,000 standing rock club I've never been to. This is not playing it safe, but it means I can still serve my D.C. base. People who won't feel comfortable going to the Kennedy Center can still come to my show. Question. I was struck by what you said about playing banjo on Beyoncé's Texas Hold'em. In a recent interview, No Depression interview, you said the whole experience was difficult, that it made clear that your value is to the world, which is not very high. Can you elaborate? Rhiannon. There's not much I can say legally about specific things. Question. It's pretty vague, which is why I was curious to hear more. Rhiannon. For me, that experience really highlighted the difference between what I do and what the heights of the industry are doing. There are definitely benefits. I've heard from people saying more people are taking banjo classes and dancing to it. It also gave me an entree into the black community that I've never had, to be honest. It's been difficult to be seen as a black musician, especially since I'm mixed. All this shit. But for the first time, I felt acceptance from the mainstream black community, which made me weep. Because this is what I'm doing it for. So that was really beautiful. What was hard for me, she pauses, was to feel that gift treated as any other transaction in the music industry. That's what was really hard. Because I certainly didn't do it for the money, I can tell you that. I did it for the mission. So my idea of what the mission is and somebody else's idea of what the mission is are not going to be the same thing. I don't do this because I want to look pretty and make a lot of money. So when I rub up against the world, it's always hard. Finally, in random notes, the Q&A. Tunde Adebimpe. You're going to drive yourself fucking crazy until you write it. Adebimpe, who co-founded TV on the Radio, processes grief and rage, but stays upbeat on his first solo album. Despite nearly 25 years as a member of TV on the Radio, the group, whose experimental amalgam of rock, post-punk, electronic, and soul made it sui generis in the 2000s New York scene. Tunde Adebimpe bristles when asked what the term rock star means to him. Whatever scenes I was coming up in a rock star was a bad thing, Adebimpe says, laughing from his L.A. home. I don't even like the term frontman. It just sounds so gross. That's not my floor of the building. In spite of the mild protestation, Adebimpe steps into the frontman role with The Black Bolts, his devastating, gorgeous debut solo album out now. Since the band's 2019 hiatus, notwithstanding a series of live shows that last year, Adebimpe has endured unimaginable loss. His sister, who is probably the closest person in the world to me, died suddenly during the pandemic at age 41. Adebimpe dedicated the album to her. After her death, I was like, I don't think I'm going to finish this record, he says. But the great thing about the safety net of art is you're just going to drive yourself fucking crazy until you write it and put it in a place where you can look at it like a scale model of these feelings. The interview. Question. How do you feel your sister manifested herself on the album? Tunde. We were 4 years apart, but we were twins, essentially. We got to kick through this weird-ass world together and had such a shared affection for things and were each other's biggest cheerleaders. Whenever one of us felt like, I'm not really sure about this, the other one just was like, well, what the fuck are you talking about? You're the shit. I've been around for 20 years, and there's nothing about you that doesn't let me know you can do whatever the fuck you want. Question. Numerous labels rejected the album. Did that affect your ego? Tunde. 100% for about 2 days. The first day I was just like, oh, right, it's not 2008 and this isn't the band. But it was good because I don't know what people are thinking and I shouldn't let that affect what I'm doing. And coming up in the punk rock DIY scene, doing basement, hardcore shows, it's like, if you tell me I can do something, the thousand ships that I'm going to launch with the words, fuck you, are going to be long and strong. Question. There's a poignant line on the new album about being in the age of tenderness and rage. Tunde. A protester made a sign at a Black Lives Matter protest in 2020 that said, this is the age of rage and tenderness. It encapsulated to me the feeling of the times. Sometimes it feels like there are waves of evil coming towards you, and you have to combat those by being a decent person and standing up for people who cannot stand up for themselves. But to do that, you have to be open to those feelings. You can't shut yourself off if you don't want to get steamrolled by racists and sexists and fascists. There's a lot to rage against, and it's because you have some kind of love in your heart that you want to fight. Question: how conscious were you of differentiating this album from TV on the radio? Tunde: with TV on the radio, I have a face recognition blindness where I know what we're made of, but I couldn't tell you how we did it. We get into this trance where we feel more about it than think. The only way for me to make something that's definitely not a TV on the radio record was if I made a country rap record. Question: were the crowds different at last year's show than in the 2000s? Tunde: one of the coolest things is there were way more black and queer kids and people of color than when we were starting, and seeing it be a regular thing instead of this weird fucking anomaly. You're talking to these young punks, and it was just like, we would have been best friends in high school, but you weren't around. And I'm so happy that anything I've done has led you in this direction. Question: you talked a lot in the past about having stage fright. Does being a solo artist amplify that fear? Tunde: I don't know if it's easier, but it's just normal now. If you're in cold weather, you're just really sharp about shit. I'm very aware of everything. I think it's mostly having a slight anxiety about wanting to do the best that you can do and leave enough space where you can still play with what you're doing. It's more of a giddiness where you're just like, oh shit, I don't know what's going to happen. I would love these shows to be really raucous. Question: you were an usher at New York's Film Forum. What's the best story from those days? Tunde: I don't know if I should say. It was a sleepy enough theater at points where we went to take the garbage out. A co-worker and I just get stoned and come back in and call out the movies in a really childish way. There's this movie called La Madame et la Putain, which translates to The Mother and the Whore. It's a great movie, but these two fucking 20-year-olds yelling like, 6:30 showing for The Mother and the Whore. Very unfilm forum. Finally, question: do you see another TV on the radio album soon, or are you in your solo mind? Tunde: I'm in solo mind, but everyone's always writing. Whenever we do things separately and come back together, it's like everyone went to either their little university or vision quest and brings back what they learned from there. Turning to Comedy's Class of 2025, the moment's brightest stars are changing the game on screen and on stage. Charlene Kay. She's played stages all over the world as an indie rocker, but with her online music parodies and a one-woman show, her dream is shifting. Like all good children of immigrants, Charlene Kay greets me with a gift. The shirt is emblazoned with neon pink lightning, the title of her comedy show, Tiger Daughter, in a Def Leppard font, and a collage of images, including a photo of her mother, Lily, well, naked as the day she was born. These are nude portraits that my mother made of herself. This is my mother's shadow looming over me, Kay explains, dragging her nails over the collage. When I was making this, it was so funny, because it occurred to me how similar we are. Oh, and this is us both showing our ass, because it runs in the family. Tiger Daughter, or How I Brought My Immigrant Mother Ultimate Shame, slots neatly into the trend of storytelling that fuses comedy and personal testimony. Previous big-name entries like Gerard Carmichael's Rothaniel and Mike Birbiglia's The Good Life have mastered the formula. Kay's version, if the full title isn't clear enough, has a familiar outline. First-gen immigrants become parents in the West, hoping their sacrifices will be rewarded with a doctor or lawyer child. Child goes another way. Conflict ensues. Over the course of about 60 minutes, Kay uses photos of her and her mom, as well as real text between them, blown up and projected behind her on stage to chart her life and career milestones and her mother's response to them. Ultimately, she tries to answer the question of whether you can truly love someone without ever fully understanding them. It's a PowerPoint presentation that plops the crowd directly into Kay's inner turmoil and asks if they relate. And based on the applause she receives at the end, it seems they do. Everyone was disappointed in their parents in some way, Kay tells me, one hand lazily stirring her coffee at a cafe in Flatbush, Brooklyn. You're never going to be that ideal. You have to figure that out for yourself. The vast majority of people who've heard of Kay know her not from Tiger Daughter, but from the wildly popular music parodies she puts out online. Think every Chappelle Roan song and every Charlie XCX song. Affectionate riffs that poke fun at an artist's musical and lyrical tendencies while celebrating their work all the same. The Taylor Swift one has more than a million views. But the reason she's so adept at breaking down what other musicians do is that she is one herself, a really, really good one. Kay's Mad Libs CV goes something like this. While attending the University of Michigan, the classically trained piano and guitar player toured with Team Star Kid, the musical theater troupe that shot to internet stardom in 2009 with its viral Harry Potter musical parody. A very Potter musical. After she released solo pop rock music under the moniker Kay, their surname of her stepfather, Marty, there are also the 5 years she fronted the indie rock band San Fermin, where she says she evolved into an outrageous, ballsy performer. She did her solo work on the side, singer-songwriter stuff she calls very deep and dark and earnest. I wanted to be a Mitski or Phoebe Bridgers, Kay says, but it wasn't taking off. Music is so youth and beauty obsessed. That's something I just got tired of because I feel like the music industry just tries to keep you at age 25 forever. All along, Kay's internet presence grew, especially as she showed off more of her comic instincts. In 2022, she posted the first video in her now legendary Guitar Center series, where she grabs merchandise off the wall and, in her words, terrorizes male employees and shoppers by purposely butchering popular riffs, like the opening notes of Smoke on the Water or Sweet Child O' Mine. In some clips, a man approaches and corrects her. Rock music is such a boys' club, Kay says. I want to just take it down in seriousness. The irony, as some commentators on those posts have pointed out, is the amount of music theory and technical know-how you'd have to have fuck up all those songs just so. At age 38, all of Kay's intensive musical training has led her to a completely new sphere of entertainment. I'm a total music head, and it's probably why I've had a lot of success in the short-form comedy space, she says, because I understand the tropes of different artists, so I'm able to map it out academically in this way that's very satisfying to me. And it turns out it's satisfying to others as well. One of those fans is the trailblazing comedian Margaret Cho, who found Kay through TikTok and has since become obsessed. Last fall, Cho launched a year-long residency as a curator at the iconic New York venue Joe's Pub with Kay's show. She's an absolute rock star. She shreds, Cho tells Rolling Stone in an email. She's a captivating performer, hilarious and exciting to watch. Tiger Daughter is a show that's been a long time coming. Kay traces her love of comedy to the stars of her youth, Tenacious D, Flight of the Conchords, Adam Sandler. Basically just a bunch of funny white dudes. She and her sister enjoyed watching as kids growing up in Arizona. Back then, comedy and theater felt like a club she was on the outside of because she was Asian American. I auditioned for Peter Pan when I was in third grade and got cast as an Indian, she says. I internalized that there were no roles for me. but performing was in her blood. As Kay notes in Tiger Daughter, her mother, who clearly has a dramatic flair and her own significant rock and roll style, entered the biggest reality show singing competition in Singapore 3 times. Twice she placed second. When her mom signed up Kay for all kinds of musical lessons, it activated that performer's DNA. Playing guitar from a young age taught me how to connect and to be bodily aware of myself on a stage, Kay says. The Star Kid years took that stage presence to a whole other level. If you were on Tumblr in 2012, and if you were a Harry Potter fan or a Glee fan, then you were hysterical about this, she says, running her hands through her candy apple red streaked hair. The venue capacities were thousands and thousands of people, and the fans were frightening. One girl showed up, and she had the signatures of all 7 Star Kids on the tour tattooed on her calves, wrapped in plastic and bleeding. During the pandemic, Kay took acting classes at a studio that specializes in the Meisner technique, a practice that prioritizes the emotion in a performance over the words. When a classmate invited her to join a theatrical showcase, she turned a Google Doc of all the crazy shit her mom had done into the skeleton of a show. I didn't have experience doing stand-up, Kay says. It was just this very specific story I had. That was my segue. Tiger Daughter traces Lily's antics, like asking her daughter to urgently Photoshop her face onto other women's bodies. It also includes painful moments that bring the audience to a hush, such as Kay's discovery of an interview her mother had given calling Charlene a spoiled and entitled disappointment. Kay acknowledges in the show the hardships her mother faced as a young woman in Singapore, food scarcity, poverty, and the dream of being a famous singer that never materialized. This dream, abandoned in Lily's life, but pursued by her daughter, is at the core of their push-pull relationship. How can I possibly repay my parents for the monumental sacrifices they made? Kay says. It is selfish to pursue my own joys, even if they are kind of outrageous. Tiger Daughter, which Kay recently toured in Melbourne, Australia, doesn't pretend to have answers. Instead, Kay rehashes every hurt, fight, deranged WhatsApp request, and crying voicemail on stage, in the hopes that sharing it with an audience will bring her closer to some form of healing. In the meantime, she's keeping the musical comedy coming. She started a femme Radiohead cover band called Labahead and has ideas for plenty more sex pun bands. These include Sisters of a Down, Limp Biz Clit, and Twink 182, which she says should only be made up of gay artists. And even after pouring her heart out night after night for years, she's still doing best known for parodies. She's okay with that. The irony is that now I'm doing Tiger Daughter, but when I get stopped on the street, it's because I'm the Taylor Swift girl from TikTok, Kay says, which is hilarious. That's my legacy. Also in comedy's class of 2025, Joss Johnson. He's gone viral with Daily Show segments and hyper-focused stand-up sets, but what the comedian really wants is to change the world. Joss Johnson can't remember all the details about this one particular bank robbery gone wrong. It happened in the 70s, or maybe it was the 80s. The amount of money stolen is hazy, but he can recall the parts that matter, the funny ones. He ran up in there, robbed the place, didn't wear a mask, the comedian says. They eventually catch up with him, and he's so shocked that he's been arrested. With an exasperated flair, the Louisiana native echoes one phrase the culprit repeated during questioning. I was wearing the juice. What did it mean? This dude, because lemon juice is an ingredient in invisible ink, he thought rubbing lemon juice on himself would make him not appear on the camera. Johnson tells a story from our table at a pizza shop near his old Brooklyn apartment. Part of me hopes it's not real. To be fair, I didn't read it in a newspaper clipping, he admits. It's from a rabbit hole of botched heights, that I went down. And I was like, I was wearing this juice. Is incredible. This very real robbery happened in Pittsburgh in 1995. If only the lemon-covered bandit would have waited 30 years, his failure might have made it into one of Johnson's viral stand-up sets. Bizarre news stories, social media spectacles, and cultural defining moments, like Drake warring with Kendrick Lamar, Trump's return to office, or the hysteria surrounding Luigi Mangione, are foundational to the 35-year-old's comedy. I'm hopefully showing enough range over time I can talk about anything, even if I don't get to everything, Johnson says. One look at his schedule and it's clear that he at least attempts to get to most things. Friday through Sunday, he performs his topical material on the road, currently as part of his Flowers Tour, which is scheduled for more than 90 dates this year. On Tuesdays, he uploads a timely new set on YouTube where he has 1.5 million subscribers. Mondays are for recording The Josh Johnson Show, the lifestyle podcast he hosts with Logan Nielsen. And Monday through Thursday are spent at his day job, The Daily Show. Johnson started as a writer on the show in 2017 during Trevor Noah's reign, before becoming a correspondent in 2024. Everyone there, he says, has really been rooting for me. In 2019, he joined Noah on tour as an opener. They ended up spending 3 years on the road together, time that taught him, through Noah's example, how to balance an already grueling day job with stand-up. His mentorship has really helped me in navigating the moment that I'm in and the moment that I'm expecting, Johnson says. With his own Flowers tour, which combines comedy with community building, Johnson is aiming for bigger and more spectacle-like shows, the kind that will send people home thinking, I had never seen somebody do this before. More than anything, he wants to leave the cities he visits better than they were when he got there. I'm trying to build comedy that's based on mutual aid communities and reaching a further understanding of each other, Johnson says. That means he partners with local organizations in each city to raise awareness, funding, and volunteer bases for shelters and outreach programs. During a recent stop in Cincinnati, $5,000 from ticket sales was donated to a nearby animal shelter. In another testament to the theme, Johnson often encourages fans to bring flowers to the shows as a friendship offering to one another. Sometimes he'll hire people to pass them out, too. Flowers are like us, he says. They're temporary, they're beautiful. You keep planting seeds, they keep growing. They're incredibly resilient, and I think they're a reminder of how much time we have and what we do with that time. When Johnson was around 6 years old, an inspired rant about something he can't recall now sent his grandmother into a fit of laughter. I could tell that this was not the type of laughing that adults do, like placating you, he says. That was one of the first times I felt funny. He was never particularly extroverted, not a class clown. When I started comedy, people who knew me growing up were surprised, he adds. The pieces clicked into place when considering Johnson's preference for dissecting cultural moments and tumbling down niche rabbit holes rather than rattling off punchline-packed jokes. My grandma and my mom, being a teacher and being a librarian, instilled some of that in me, he says, to go find out anything that I was curious about and find a way to express myself that was productive. There's a trust Johnson has in his voice that developed while growing up with no siblings and only a sparse group of friends. He was usually his own audience. When you're an only child, you end up spending so much time alone that you could be introspective in a way where you're very certain how you feel about things, he says. It's why I think the way I think. The Daily Show, of course, is less solitary. In viral segments, he's roasted Mark Zuckerberg. He looks like if Napoleon Dynamite grew up in Detroit. And called Sesame Street's Cookie Monster a little blue bitch for complaining about shrinkflation. When Johnson's correspondent duties sent him out for man-on-the-street interviews, the great people of New York bring the material to him. He's challenged passerbyers to describe black history stories without using DEI terms, leading one participant to ask, "Can I say seat?" and another to declare, "It was Tubac who learned the most out of Frederick Douglass." His bewildered facial expressions are a form of comedy on their own. "What I enjoy about doing Daily Show is the collaborative aspect," Johnson says. "In stand-up, you get to see my most raw feelings on a subject. In Daily Show, you get to see my efforts contributed to the larger effort of everyone that works there, in front of and behind the camera." He admits both can be sort of scary, but he has people to lean on at work. With his own shows, there's no way to know if he's meeting the moment until he's up there taking his best shot at it. He feels the weight of his responsibility as an entertainer when he comes face to face with the audience he's trying to reach. "You see these numbers, but when you meet the people, that's a very different thing," he says. "I met someone who was saying that she watches while she does her chemotherapy. I'll never forget that. I hope that she's never watching me like, 'That one wasn't worth it.' That would be terrible. It's like now you have to triple down on the work that you put in." Johnson isn't naive to think he'll never miss the mark. "Eventually, I'm going to say something that makes you roll your eyes," he says. He doesn't believe his charity comedy hybrid is necessarily world-changing either, but he sees a desperate need for community everywhere he goes. "I've traveled to many parts of the country and seen all these different facets of people, racist, homophobic, gay, whatever," he says. "I've seen too many people to be convinced they're so massively different then some form of change can't occur. Maybe that change will come from an encounter in his audience, a meet and greet after a set, or the outreach organizers there. It all counts. I don't know if my efforts will be futile," Johnson says, "but this is the best way that I know how to help. That's my earnest attempt. Anything else would be dishonest." Lion of the Late Night, the Rolling Stone interview. Jimmy Kimmel. "Now I see myself more as a place to scream." The president and the richest man on the planet hate Jimmy Kimmel. You would think that would bestow on him a resistance status, at the very least grants a private office in the upper reaches of the Masonic Temple in Hollywood, where Jimmy Kimmel Live is shot live on tape 4 nights a week. This is not the case. The talk show's host workspace is very public, with an assistant's desk next to his and 2 more staffers peering in from the other side of a large wall of glass, much like his producers did in his early days as a shock jock. The only secluded corner holds a bathroom and a closet containing a cardboard box full of worn ties that his idol David Letterman sent him upon his retirement. "I wore one, but they're so long," says Kimmel, who had a late-night TV shirt under his suit when Jimmy Kimmel Live debuted in 2003. His arms disappear into the box. "You gotta take one." For a decade, Kimmel was happy to be a Letterman disciple, projecting a just-snarky-to-be-there vibe, pulling pranks on Matt Damon and his own Aunt Chippy. There were chats with sidekick Guillermo Rodriguez, who was promoted in Letterman fashion from security guard to on-air talent. It all benefited the Vegas-raised Kimmel, who before all this was best known for co-hosting Comedy Central The Man Show with Adam Carolla, a program that either celebrated or skewered the frat boy lifestyle. Then the rise and fall and rise of Donald Trump changed his life. A new Kimmel emerged. This one, initially propelled by anger at Trump and the Republicans' approach to health care and gun violence, savages Trump nightly, leading the president to make calls to Disney in 2018, urging it to rein him in. Disney did not. Now Kimmel has Elon Musk in his sights. A few days after we talked, Kimmel derided Musk after he begged for civility following a wave of Tesla vandalism and expressed bewilderment about why folks were mad at him. "Well, let me see if I can explain it for you," said Kimmel. "When you pull out a chainsaw to celebrate firing thousands of people, they get mad. My God. I mean, this poor guy. You do one, maybe two Nazi salutes. Everybody gets all bent out of shape." Musk responded by labeling Kimmel as an unfunny jerk. Kimmel and I talked in his office for 2.5 hours after a March taping of his show. We made a pledge not to talk about Trump for the whole time. We sort of failed, but Kimmel did manage to work Harold Stern, Michelangelo's David, and stalker culture into one cogent soundbite. Dad Rock talk about Kimmel's good friend Huey Lewis's first band Clover has been edited out for space. The interview. The question. Your office has two staffers looking in. It's hard to imagine Letterman having this kind of setup. Kimmel? There's no alone time. If I have a private call, it's taken in the bathroom. Question. Are you feeling okay? During yesterday's taping, you appeared to be in some physical distress. Kimmel. I had some very serious stomach cramping. It just came upon me suddenly. You come close to seeing me shit my pants on stage for the first time. It's weird. Whatever is going on always stops when I take the stage. If I'm hiccuping, it stops. Sneezing, it stops. But diarrhea waits for no man. Question. I see your clarinet over there. I know you're pretty good, but how the hell did you make that your instrument of choice? Kimmel. Well, I didn't choose it. It chose me. And I don't say that the way Jimi Hendrix might say it. I say it the way Jimmy Kimmel would say it, which is, I thought it was a trombone. I wanted to play the trombone and thought a trombone when I was 12 years old was called a clarinet. So I signed up for clarinet class and I got to class and some kids had their instruments. I told the band teacher, I'm in the wrong class. I'm supposed to be in the clarinet class. And he said, this is the clarinet class. I said, no clarinet. I did the trombone motion with my hand, and I remember the teacher laughing so hard. He goes, no, that's a trombone. And I said, oh. And he said, we'll rearrange your schedule. And I was like, okay. And I went home, and my mom had bought me a clarinet, and my parents never bought anything. And I didn't know you could return things. So I felt too guilty to say, no, I wanted to play the trombone. So I just said, I won't change the schedule. And I'll play the clarinet. And here we are. Question. I hate to do this, but let's start with Trump. Kimmel. Donald Trump? Yeah, used to be me you think of. You think of Guillermo or Matt Damon not getting on the show. Now it's Trump. I think most comedians have a strong sense of justice, and Trump violates that so frequently. I know we would be hardened to it by now, but I'm not. It's shocking to me. It seems like a comic book villain. He seems like the kind of character that would flame out after a few years, but the fact that he's still with us is remarkable. A year ago, I would have said I'm hoping to show people who aren't paying attention to the news what's actually going on and hoping to change things that way. Obviously, that didn't have enough impact before the election, so now I see myself as a place to scream. Question. From a comedy point of view, there are some advantages, right? Kimmel. You don't have to set the joke up because everyone knows everything about him. So you go right to the punchline. The problem is Trump's somebody that a lot of people don't like. They don't want to hear his name. But there's always material. Some days Trump gives you so much that you're throwing things away that would have been the biggest event of the entire Bush presidency. I try not to get too deep in the weeds. I have to remind myself that this is not an exposé. It is a comedy show. Question. When did you realize, oh shit, this is serious and no longer just ridiculous? Kimmel, it was 2016 and I had Hillary Clinton on. I said to Hillary during a commercial break, I hope Trump gets the nomination. I think he'll be a slam dunk for you. And she said, be careful what you wish for. I'm not in the group of people who thought he might win. Listen, when O.J. was found not guilty, I was just absolutely shocked. I had that same feeling. I had this faith in America that was shaken, and I'm still not over it. I thought that when it comes down to it, this country, we do the right thing. That's obviously in the past. Question. You saw this up close in 2017. Your son was born with a serious heart condition while the Republicans were trying to repeal Obamacare. What made you go public about such a personal thing? Kimmel. There were a few things. I was sitting in the hospital. I was watching them debate this in Congress. I was watching them decide on whether Americans would have access to health insurance or not. And I'm looking around this hospital and seeing all these kids and families that are obviously poor. And the idea that if these people were your next-door neighbors, you would do anything you could to help them struck me. Healthcare is boring, and most people don't understand it. So I just wanted to humanize it the best way I possibly could. Question. You had Senator Bill Cassidy on the show to explain your son's condition, and he promised that any health care bill would pass the Jimmy Kimmel test, and pre-existing conditions would be covered. Then the Republican bill came out, and that didn't happen. Were you surprised? Kimmel, I was surprised. When I spoke to Bill Cassidy on the air, I thought, this man is a doctor. He understands this better than most politicians. And I felt that he was going to seize that moment and make himself a hero to Americans by doing the right thing. And I was quite surprised that he didn't. And thank God John McCain did. I will always be grateful to him. Question. I wonder if that experience gave you insight into the Republican Party during the Trump years in terms of they are not going to display a moment of courage even when it seems like it's in America's best interest. Kimmel. Were they so scared of him? I think even more so now than they were the first time around because he's so vindictive and there's no length to which he will not go to punish you. I just don't understand how Americans can support what he's doing and the stupid stuff that he gets hung up on, like transgender sports, and the stuff that affects almost no one. I know politicians do this. They pick little things they know are going to push your buttons, and those are the things that they go with. But this is an extreme that we've never seen before. There's no decency. It's just a bunch of animals, and it's disgusting. I mean, on the 4th of July, I still put up a flag, and I'm never going to stop doing that, because I'm never going to let them have that symbol. It's not their flag. It's not a MAGA brand. Question. I wonder if you see Elon Musk in a similar light in the sense that, like Trump, he gives you so much material. Kimmel? Well, he's kind of the same as Trump in a lot of ways. I mean, he supported Obama and then Hillary, and now it's convenient for him to support Trump. And to me, those are the worst people. I don't think Trump believes in any of it, and I don't think Elon Musk believes in it. I think Elon Musk sees this as a great way to accrue a lot of power and make a lot of money, and that's exactly what he's doing. Here's where I realized Elon Musk was a very bad person and a dangerous person. When Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, an elderly man, was viciously attacked, his first reaction was to repost a brazenly false story suggesting that it was a male prostitute that did it. That's when I realized, oh, this is a bad person. There's no depth to which he will not stoop. An old man was hit with a hammer, and that's his first reaction. It's vile. Question. Do you think Trump has actual true believers? Stephen Miller? Kimmel. Yeah, he's a scary motherfucker, that guy. Question. Tucker Carlson. Kimmel. Oh, he's a complete phony. He's an opportunist. When you look at Tucker Carlson, you go, okay, this is a smart guy. And then you see him over in Russia in a supermarket holding up fruit and going, this apple is only 12 cents. In America, you pay 50 cents for this apple. And you go, yes, but the minimum wage in Russia is a dollar an hour. And what he's doing there is acknowledging his fans are not too swift, and he doesn't care. Question. We published a story in 2023 that Trump was phoning ABC calling for you to be fired. You seem pissed yet amused. Kimmel, I think it's funny. I like when he admits I'm bothering him. here at the show, where we put a lot of work into lampooning him, for him to acknowledge our work is one of the few things he does that I appreciate. If he ignored us, it wouldn't be as much fun. One thing I like to think about is whether this ruins having been president for President Obama. Being president used to be a big deal. It's really been cheapened. Maybe it's how Johnny Carson and David Letterman felt when we all got talk shows. Question. You grew up in Las Vegas in the 1980s. Was that weird or normal? Kimmel. It was a very normal place to grow up, and also a very abnormal place to grow up. And I didn't really understand that until I moved away. I played Little League, and I was an altar boy, and we went to church every Sunday. But also on the weekends, we would go for the $1.99 steak dinner at 2 o'clock in the morning. I'd walk around downtown Las Vegas with a video camera doing interviews with tourists, and then when we'd go home, we would watch it. And then we'd tape over the same tape and do it again the next weekend because that was our only VHS tape. Question. Do you remember your first Las Vegas show as a kid? Kimmel. I went to one with my buddy Cleto, who's my band leader now. We went to see the show called Splash. There was water on the stage, and the women were topless. But the opening was Frank Gorshin, who played the Riddler on Batman. He was a stand-up comic. You could see he was dead inside opening for Splash. I remember they gave us two Heinekens, and we were pretty hammered by the time Frank wrapped up his set. We gave him a standing ovation at the end. He just glared at us. I also saw Siegfried and Roy at the Frontier Hotel, and the elephants on stage were urinating so forcefully they were splashing these Japanese businessmen in front row. They didn't seem very happy. Question. Tell me about your earliest comedy memories. I had an audio cassette recorder, and before Letterman came on, I would watch Carson, and specifically when Bill Cosby was hosting for Johnny. I taped the monologue and I transcribed it because I wanted to see what it looked like. But I didn't have any intention of being a comedian, and that never occurred to me. I had a late-night license plate and had a late-night birthday cake because I loved Letterman so much that I thought I could do it someday. Question. Your family seems to have been an essential part of your comedy upbringing. Many are on the show. Kimmel. My Aunt Chippy has always been a source of great amusement for me. I have these old notebooks where my cousin Sal and I wrote a bunch of fake Aunt Chippy quotes, which seemed like things she would say, like, Frank, goddammit, I'll punch you in the face, knock all your teeth out, and make it into a necklace. I remember my mom would scare my dad in the shower. She'd scare him and laugh really hard at it. My mom used to pretend she was dead. She'd lay on the ground, pretend she was dead until we cried. And then I found out my Aunt Chippy would do it too. And then my grandfather told me his mother would do it to him. And I was like, look at this. This is a deep sickness. It deserves a psychological examination. Question. Your Aunt Chippy is in a hilarious skit where she doesn't understand why her taxi doesn't have a driver. It's a Waymo. But my favorite is when your cousin Mickey is scared first by a wax dummy of you and then by your human form, which she thinks is a wax dummy. Kimmel, Mickey is great because she will believe anything. She's trusting. I once told her that there's a place called Ice Cream Town and it's got all these different stores. And you go to one store, it's a scoop of vanilla ice cream store. And then you go across the street to the other store if you want chocolate syrup. And then there's the cherry store. And she's like, oh my God, this sounds great. Meanwhile, if you really think about it realistically, it's a huge pain in the ass. She's very sweet and her own very smart. She's also very gullible. Question. Cousin Sal has been with you for years and now he's multi-platforming in every direction. Kimmel. Let me tell you something. I had dinner with Barack Obama the other night, and we spent about a solid 15 minutes talking about Cousin Sal. He listens to the Bill Simmons and Cousin Sal podcast, and it was blowing my mind. I couldn't believe it because my Cousin Sal is, first of all, one of the most unusual and funniest people you'll ever meet in your life. And Obama was talking about Parents' Corner, where Sal talks of his travails raising three boys. The closest person I can compare Sal to the people would get is Bill Murray, in that he has impulses and acts on them, even if they're completely unsocial and they're always funny. Question, are you continuing the prank tradition with your own kids? Kimmel, oh yeah. This weekend we're putting up signs in our neighborhood that says, we've lost our chimpanzee, and warning people not to get too close to it, but if they see it, call us. We're going to put them up on the telephone poles in the neighborhood, and I got a burner phone number, so if people call, they get a response. Question. Radio seemed to be your gateway drug into comedy. Kimmel. That was where it was for me. The radio show I did when I was in high school on a college radio station, we had a fake rap band. We would make songs that were funny, and I made a lot of crank calls that I would tape. And Cleto was learning to play the piano, so we'd learn certain tunes, and we'd make up funny songs for them. And that's when I thought, yeah, this is what I want to do. I want to be like Harold Stern. Radio is still the best medium because they can't see you, and it's very freeing in the same way actors are more comfortable in a costume playing a character. Really, you can say whatever pops into your head and be really loose. Question, Howard Stern is one of your heroes and is now a friend. How did you meet him? Kimmel, when I started on The Man Show, Comedy Central hired a publicist for us for the show, and I said to him, there's just one thing I want to do, because I've already seen him on Letterman. I wanted to be on Howard Stern. And he's like, oh, okay, all right. It took years, and we were on the show on the phone. It was me and Adam Carolla. We were on together, and he seemed to like us okay on the air. And then Adam started filling in the spot that eventually became Artie Lang's spot. And he and Adam started to become friendly. And I was a little bit jealous because Adam wasn't necessarily really even a fan of the show. Still, to this day, I listen to him every morning. I think his show is better than it has ever been. I'm humbled by him. He's one of my very good friends, and he's one of the few people I can really turn to when I need advice because he's been through all this stuff and then some. This concludes this week's Rolling Stone magazine. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.